Case number 09-7013, Trina Stewart, appellant versus St. Elizabeth's Hospital et al. Ms. Jones for the appellant, Ms. Johnson for the appellees.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Jones, and I represent the appellant in this case, Trina Stewart. Your Honors, after Trina Stewart was transferred to the John Howard Pavilion in 2002 until her suicide attempt on October 15, 2002, her disability was open, obvious, and apparent to her supervisors and her coworkers in such a way that it gave them notice that Ms. Stewart was disabled, that she was in need of an accommodation.
What's the best record evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the best evidence that you know of that supports that? That is, that meets the Crandall standard. Quote, so obviously a manifestation of an underlying disability. So what would you point to as the most compelling evidence that meets that standard?
I would point A to Ms. Stewart's deposition transcript and testimony about what her conditions were presenting.
And what, I would what did also she point say? What, exactly, which one? Where she said what?
Where she said that she was hearing voices, that she was paranoid, that she was...
But did she convey that to someone?
Well, Your Honor...
She said that in her deposition, but did she tell that to... A supervisor?
She did not tell that to a supervisor because...
So where's the best evidence?
The best evidence of
her
that.
Behavior, because you agree that she didn't at any time, there's no evidence that she at any time told, I mean, until her last meeting there with, what's his name? The
Jameer?
No.
Harling? Burnett?
Burnett. Up until her conversation with Burnett, did she tell anybody that she had a medical disability of any kind?
She didn't know that she had a medical disability.
Okay, but so she didn't. So your argument rests on the fact that they should have known from her behavior, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So and my question was, what evidence, what do you point to as the evidence that supports that?
I point to Joint Appendix page 146 to 147.
Which
and that is
what?
That is the affidavit by her supervisor, Paula Prelio. Perlio, I'm sorry, where Ms. Perlio describes several incidents in which she and her co-supervisor of Ms. Stewart observed her uncontrollable crying, that she was exhibiting inappropriate threats of violence and paranoia as it related to her relationship with some other people, some of her co-workers, that she was that Ms. Perlio was, in fact, so worried about her that she was afraid for her to drive back to her home, that it came to a point that at one point she called Harling and Tremere, Riley Tremere, into a meeting to discuss Trina Stewart.
If somebody were upset attending to inmates because of the inmate's behavior, the exhibitionism, shouts, profanity, whatever, and that individual who was attending to them started crying and got upset and was shaking, would that person have be displaying a disability?
But that, not in and of itself.
No.
Crandall
says that if you're showing outward symptoms that are consistent with non-disability, as well as maybe consistent with disability, then you can't prevail, doesn't it?
Your Honor, but that's not this case. And this case, as it relates to, as Ms. Perlow relates in her affidavit.
You don't disagree with the proposition. You agree with its application to the facts of the case.
Correct. That a discrete incident of something happening at a job where someone starts to cry and is upset, that's one thing. But when you have a supervisor who is so concerned about that individual's emotional stability, she calls her fellow supervisors into an office, and they go over and talk about what is going on with Trina Stewart. And Ms. Perlow says in her affidavit that Ms. Stewart was sick. She was getting sick. She had been sick. She was sick at the time that they were having this meeting. Well, which belies the notion that it was just a discrete observation based on this one incident. Yes, Your Honor.
She was stressed out because of family issues, the memo says.
That's what Mr. Tremere says. In the meeting, Mr. Tremere says, well, I think Ms. Stewart is stressed out behind family, worrying about family worries and losing her sister and her uncle. And Ms. Perlow says, Ms. Perlow told Mr. Tremere that Ms. Stewart was getting sick way before her sister's or her uncle's death. Now, that belies...
What are you on 146?
147, Your Honor, first paragraph.
Right.
Second sentence.
Okay.
And so that, Your Honor, belies the notion or an argument that her supervisors had viewed her condition on just one discrete event, and that a reasonable jury could reasonably infer, based on this information, and based on, coupled with Ms. Stewart's deposition transcript about how she was presenting that, including her outward presentation, her loss of weight, her uncontrollable crying, not just at the time of the event with the inmate, but throughout throughout that period. Based on that, a reasonable jury could conclude that the supervisors knew just from that sentence. Ms. Perlow knew that she was sick. Did she know that she was manic depressive? Did she know that she was schizophrenic? Did she know that she was? She didn't know. But that's not the standard that this circuit and other circuits have provided for plaintiffs in terms of their burden. Particularly in this kind of case, this is a quintessential mental health disability case where a person is presented, she has the symptoms, she's clearly psychotic, she's hearing voices, and she's delusional, and she's paranoid. But she doesn't understand what's going on with her. And she's so paranoid that she doesn't want the people at her office, at her job, to really know about it. And those are some of the factors that Crandall and Phoenixville.
That? I mean, that's a really interesting dilemma that you've presented. I mean, you said that in your brief, too. I mean, what the problem is that the Crandall requires that the you're totally right. Someone who's paranoid is probably not going to say anything, yet the law requires that the employee either put the employer on notice or behave in such a way that it was so obvious that the employer should have known. I mean, that's the legal standard we have to deal with here.
Yes, Your Honor, and I submit that Perlow's affidavit,
uh-huh,
where she says, Ms. Stewart was getting sick way before.
Right.
She was sick then, and she was getting sick. We can parse the word sick, but from a common sense reading, a reasonable jury could make the determination that when Ms. Perlow said in that meeting with the other supervisors, with Ms. Stewart's other supervisors, that Ms. Stewart had been sick, she was sick, she was getting sicker, coupled with Ms. Stewart's own testimony about how she was presenting, that a reasonable jury could conclude that that her condition was so obvious that they had been presumed to have known. Not that they in fact did know, because right. That's what she says she knew.
If you're right about that, don't you still have to get over the next hurdle, right? Which is to show that she requested an accommodation, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And what do you have for that?
Your Honor, there is no doubt that for a variety of reasons, particularly because of her own mental condition, that Ms. Stewart did not say, I am mentally ill and I need to do X.
Right.
But that's not necessarily her burden, particularly in mental health cases.
I agree, but she does have to ask for an accommodation.
Well, she does. I think the record is clear that Ms. Stewart made it abundantly clear to all of her supervisors or a reasonable jury can infer that she did, that she was not happy at John Howard Pavilion.
Well, what were the reasons she gave for that? Didn't she give, one reason, as I recall, was that she didn't like working with the chemicals, right?
Well, that was one reason.
And another was that she didn't like the people, her co-workers, right?
That was one reason.
But one of them wasn't that I have a disability.
And precisely, Your Honor, because she was ill and she didn't want people to know that she was sick. And I would suggest to you, because I had...
So what do you see? It's the same dilemma. It's really an interesting problem, isn't it? Because, as you point out, this is an area where the disability may itself explain why the person didn't either explain it to the employer or ask for an accommodation, yet that puts the employer in a pretty difficult position, doesn't it?
It does, Your Honor, and I don't necessarily...
So what do we do about that?
Well, once again, based on her testimony and the affidavit from Ms. Perlow and... This evidence wasn't presented to trial judge for summary judgment.
I understand what you're saying about the record, but the specific problem of a paranoid employee who, because of the disability, will not or is unable to explain it to the employer or ask for a transfer, because that's the dilemma you've raised here, right?
I do have an answer to
that. Yeah, what is it? That's what I'm looking for.
Well, I think that employers have employee assistant programs, and they refer employees who, without their consent, into employee assistance programs all the time.
Oh, big employers do, but little ones don't.
Well, but this is the government. Yeah. I mean, and not necessarily an employee assistant. My point is that once, if you conclude that Ms. Stewart's condition during this period was bad and getting worse,
right,
that she was not taking care of herself, that she was losing weight, all of that stuff. And these are people who don't work at McDonald's, they work at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. They know a mentally ill person when they see it.
Well, but they're lay people. They're not professionals.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I would submit that if an employee came in demonstrably drunk and who was otherwise a fairly good performer, came in demonstrably drunk on a regular basis, that employee, employer, could and would provide that individual with some counseling. Or they get terminated.
Is that a disability?
Drinking. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Drinking's not a disability.
Well, I think alcoholism can be a disability, sure.
It is?
Yes.
What you're describing,
I mean, under some circumstances.
What you're describing is catch-22, right?
You know,
if you say you're too crazy to engage in combat, you must be sane, right?
And with that, Your Honor, I will...
Okay, thank you.
I'll come back. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Holly Johnson, representing the District of Columbia. I'd like to start with the question that you ended with, the question about what to do with regard to employees that are perhaps too ill, too mentally ill, to indicate to their employer that they are mentally ill. And I think that the answer cannot lie with the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act. These statutes are anti-discrimination statutes, and the underlying principle of discrimination is that it's wrongdoing on the part of the employer. There are other statutes designed to protect employees who are injured in the workplace, and that includes mental injuries. There are statutes designed to protect employees who, due to an employer's negligence, suffer some sort of an injury. But for there to be intentional discrimination, and this court has held that it's the bedrock principle of the Rehabilitation Act, the employer must know of the injury. So while it's, I think, a sad situation for employees such as Ms. Stewart, who perhaps was disabled earlier and was unable to communicate that with her employees.
You can't expect employers to do differential analysis of mental illnesses. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying, and I would go one step further. I would say it is inappropriate for an employer to do that with regard to their employees. I think that there would be a serious risk of violating an employee's privacy if the employee is not obviously, and I mean obviously to the extent of constructive knowledge for the employer, is not obviously disabled. I think there's some risk for an employer intruding into an employee's life and personal life to find out if they're all right. I would point this court to the Taylor versus Principal Financial Group, what I've referred to as Taylor 1 in my brief. And this isn't on point to the obviousness of the disability, but it does sort of suggest the same standard for the obviousness of a need for an accommodation. And that case specifically states that the ADA discourages an employer from assuming that a disabled employee needs an accommodation. And I think that similarly there would be concerns with an employer assuming that someone who is showing some sort of erratic behavior is automatically disabled.
I understand your answer to that. But so what about these two pieces of evidence that counsel focused on? You agree, though, that, well, Crandall's the law, so you agree with Crandall. So, I mean, the employee doesn't have to specifically tell the employer if the employee's behavior is so obvious that the employer should know, right? So she cites two things. She cites Prelo's statement that plaintiff had been getting sick even before her sister's death. And Harling told Prelo that he saw her shaking, talking to herself.
And crying.
Shaking, crying, and talking to herself. So why isn't, and the question we have to ask is we have to give, you know, we have to look at the evidence most favorable to the plaintiff, and we have to ask whether a reasonable jury could conclude that, based on that, the employer should have known.
We do, and so we look at those two pieces separately.
So why isn't that enough?
Separately.
Okay.
I'd first like to discuss, actually this applies to specifically to the crying, shaking, and talking to herself incident.
Okay.
As I mentioned in my brief, I think it's critical to note that summary judgment was not granted with regard to incidents occurring in the fall of 2002. And we have no idea from the record whether this incident with Mr. Harling occurred during the fall of 2002. Now, this evidence wasn't put in the trial record. It's not part of the trial, the question of the directed verdict. So at the outset, we're asking a jury to completely speculate as to when this incident occurred, because if it occurred within the fall of 2002, it has no impact on this court's ruling, on the district court's ruling at summary judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the fall of 2002, on the summary judgment record, Ms. Stewart already had informed Mr. Burnett that she had a mental illness, and the obviousness standard completely falls away. But secondly, I think even if it wasn't speculative to assume that that occurred beforehand, the lack of evidence about the incident, the underlying incident, makes it impossible for a jury to reasonably find that the district, that the supervisors at St. Elizabeth's had constructive knowledge, had actual constructive knowledge that she was disabled based on the fact that on one incident she was apparently hysterical. All we know about the incident is these vague allegations in the memo. We know something happened with regard to Mr. Trimmer and a housekeeping aide that really angered Ms. Stewart. We know that something that had to do with this incident caused other employees to ask her what was going on with her and Mr. Trimmer and whether she had AIDS. We don't know what happened. It's entirely possible that what happened is the type of thing that someone who's not disabled could become hysterical and upset about. And if you apply the Crandall standard, we have one incident described in the Prelo memo. It's a single incident. And if you look at the standard, it just doesn't rise to that standard, even as a matter of law, even to get to a factual question. Beyond that, to address Ms. Prillo's comment regarding Ms. Stewart getting sick, It's very important to distinguish between the word sick and disabled, because there has to be constructive knowledge that someone is actually disabled, which is unable to perform their life functions. Now, if you look at the rest of the work record of Ms. Stewart, she was performing her work functions just fine. She even concedes in her response to the district's statement of undisputed material facts that her leave record gives no indication that she was suffering any sort of disability. And beyond that, you then have to take the statement that she was getting sick and combine that with the issue of whether she needed an accommodation. Now, she didn't ask for an accommodation.
Well, no, we don't get to, we don't have to get to the accommodation question if the employer wasn't aware.
That's true.
Okay, so
that is true. And I would say in the first instance, it doesn't qualify
On
its own. I think the constructive.
So your case rests on the fact that she used the word sick, not.
It does, but I could also point.
Suppose she had said mentally sick.
I still don't think that would apply.
Think that would have been enough?
I don't, and I would point you actually to the Eighth Circuit Miller case.
Even if she had said, I think she was getting mentally sick even before her sister died?
I would have concerns about that being enough, considering the fact that
Why?
It was a statement in retrospect. Because if you look at the other case law, and I mean, I think this is really important, I know that Crandall controls here, but the other circuits provide some guidance, and their cases show that the level of knowledge for an employer to reach this constructive knowledge standard is much more than someone thinking somebody was having mental illness issues. I'd point this court to the Miller case, where the Eighth Circuit found that there was no obviousness of manic depression, despite the fact that the employer knew the employee had been diagnosed with situational stress reaction, and the sister had actually warned that the sister of the employee had warned the employer that she was mentally falling apart.
Well, maybe that case is wrong.
It could be, but I think it provides this court with some guidance. If you look at the only case out there that I was able to find in which they found the mental disability was obvious, what had happened there was the employee had been, and the employer knew this, hospitalized for 3 weeks for a mental illness. The employer knew she was still seeing a psychiatrist, and the employer knew she was being monitored for lithium dosage. That's the type of standard that we're looking at. Because again, we're not talking about whether the employer should have known in a sense that perhaps would raise a duty of care in a negligence case. We're talking about whether the employer discriminated against the employee. And unless the employee told the employer that she suffered from a disability, the standard has to be akin to constructive knowledge. It has to be an actual knowledge.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Did Ms. Jones have any more time?
Ms. Jones does not have any more time.
Okay, you can take 2 minutes. And what's your response to Ms. Johnson's point that you and I were discussing, that look, this is a discrimination law, and you know, that's critical to it is that the employer actually know about the disability, otherwise it's no discrimination.
Well, the standard is not that the employer actually
no, or have constructive knowledge, but that's one way or another. I mean, I'm getting to the point about that you and I were discussing about what do you do with a plaintiff.
Well, I think
she said her answer was, look, that's just not an ADA issue.
Well, I think there's a reason why Congress and the courts have read in or specifically denoted a standard by the employer that was called the interactive process. And built in that is some burden by the employer to not just sit back and stand by while an employee is demonstrably ill. And I think
it's very tough as an employer, because if you intervene too early, as we were discussing earlier, that can pose its own sets of difficulties, sometimes legal difficulties, right?
I absolutely are.
Just because there's an incident where someone's emotional doesn't, you know, careful about what you're doing as an employer in response to that, right?
And absolutely, Your Honor. I would suggest, though, that when it has gotten to the point where one supervisor has observed her talking to herself, which is not a symptom that one would normally have even under a stressful situation like the inmate incident, And that eventually all of the supervisors come together in a meeting to discuss just Trina Stewart and what to do about her. You know, and as Wiley Tremier says in his trial testimony, they didn't know what to do, and he was very frank about that. I understand and appreciate that there is a catch-22, so to speak, with regard to what an employer is required to do too soon, too late. This was getting a borderline. It was obviously too late because within a month, but for the grace of God, Ms. Stewart would have been successful in her suicide attempt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. Case is submitted.